from high atop Bronson Towers, nestled in the foothills of the Sandia Mountains in the high desert of New Mexico. Transmitting from Studio 1B, this is The Matthew Bronson Show. We're back for another episode of The Matthew Bronson Show in conversations in the discussion of the next class or series of classes at PACE, which is Placidus Area Community Education. And Dr. Judith Hendry is here. And so, Judy, let everybody know. This is kind of like the beginning of Family Feud, where tell me about yourself.
Okay. Well, I just recently retired after teaching for 25 years in the Department of Communication and Journalism at the University of New Mexico. And my area of research and specialty is an area called environmental communication. And I taught this course that I will be teaching for PACE for many years. I wrote the textbook for the course, and it's a very timely and relevant and interesting area of study that I'm looking forward to telling you all about.
Is it common in the, I'll guess, the university world, where the professor will also write the book? Isn't that kind of like a doctor can't operate on a family member?
I wouldn't say it's common. Obviously, professors write textbooks, but this, let's see, I think I'm the only one in the department using my own textbook. So I will tell you, though, that if that publishing a textbook is no easy matter, it is. First of all, very difficult to find a publisher. There's a lot of competition. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it goes through just a tremendous review process. It is reviewed and reviewed again and re-reviewed again after I finally finished writing the book in its entirety. It was sent out to 8 independent reviewers who read through the entire book. And so it has been through a very thorough jury process for writing college textbooks.
I have to assume that there were some comments and suggestions from the reviewers.
Oh, yes.
Was there anything or a couple of things that they all said, I like this, I don't like this, that's patently wrong, in their opinion?
Yeah, no, the reviews have been very positive, both the first edition and the second edition. Reviewers were very excited about it, delighted to finally have a textbook that was, and of course they've all got their own little things that they would like to see changed or included in the book, but generally very positive reviews.
It's expensive also, isn't
it? It is expensive.
And is that a reason it's paperback versus hardback?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And not to give away your fame and fortune, but how many are in circulation now?
You know what? I don't know the answer to that question.
How many universities are using it?
I think there's about 60 universities.
That's
using
quite a bit.
It right now. Yeah, it's.
So you're famous.
Well, not quite famous, but I'm famous probably within the environmental communication world.
You're not going to go on The View or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, probably not. Not unless I do something pretty spectacular.
From what we've been talking about before we went on there, it sounds pretty spectacular to me.
Well, thank you.
It's the first, and everyone will figure all this out as we go through the conversation. It is one of the few intelligent perspectives on what we're going to talk about that in my life that I've had. So I'm thrilled that you're here.
Well, great. Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Most people don't say that, but thank you. We're born and raised in South Dakota,
yes,
America. I assume that was because that's where your parents lived.
That's where I grew up, on a farm outside of a small town called Milbank, South Dakota. Graduated from South Dakota State University.
Well, at that time, did you have the option to go to a different university? Or?
You know, not really.
Okay.
Obviously, I had some options, but my brother graduated from South Dakota State, and then my other brother, and then, you know, it was kind of a family tradition. I really didn't even think about going anywhere else.
Is it my ignorance as an American thinking that it would be largely an agricultural university?
It is. It is a land-grant university.
And did you study agriculture? Or?
I studied communication. I started with an undergraduate degree in communication, then got a master's, and then a PhD.
So they at least offered it there?
Yeah.
But did you do all three degrees at South Dakota?
No, I did my undergraduate degree there, and then I took off and played music for 14 years.
Oh.
Then I finally went back for the master's degree at Cal State Los Angeles, and finished up my PhD at the University of Denver.
Were you in high school band? Is that?
I was. Well, I was actually a majorette.
Okay.
But yeah.
You don't meet a lot of PhDs who were majorettes.
Yeah, no. But yeah, in high school, I got very involved in music, and especially with the flute. I actually went to college on a flute scholarship, and when that scholarship was up, I switched majors because I didn't want to teach music. And to this day, as much and as big a part of music is in my life, I don't enjoy teaching it.
Why New Mexico? How did you end up here?
My husband was actually transferred here. He worked with Motorola at the time. So it was a job transfer for us. And when I got here, I was teaching in Chicago at the time. And so when I got here, I just went to UNM and said, I'm here.
See Lucky you.
See what you can do to give me a job. So I started out as an adjunct, and then I received a visiting professorship, and then finally they found me this permanent position that I have been in for the last 20 years. So I was very lucky to be able to step in to a teaching position like that.
And so when you became a New Mexican, what part of the area did you live in?
We have lived only here for the last...
In Placitas?
Only here in Placitas.
How did you find Placitas 20 years ago? It was even a smaller town.
Yeah. It's kind of a funny story. We told our realtor when we got here, we don't want to see any of those adobe-style homes. We don't like them.
You're in the right place.
Right. And she said, well, fine, but I'd like you to just look at one of them, and I want you to see this area out here. She said, it's really beautiful, and you're just going to love it. And so let's just give it an open mind. So we toured the house. The first house that we toured out here is the one that we actually bought. We fell in love with that adobe style that we thought we didn't like. And, of course, this is just a beautiful place to live. We have never regretted it. Placitas is very special.
In so many ways. Yeah. The people who haven't been here since they were 10, I always like to ask, do you remember your first green chili cheeseburger?
Can't say that I do.
Are you a fan?
I am absolutely a fan.
I was off at the local market, Albertsons, I think I can say that, a few weeks ago when the Hatch chilies came out. And I worked here commuting years ago, but permanent residence about 5 years. And I realized when I saw those stacks of cases of Hatch chilies, it was like I was almost as excited when I knew Santa Claus was going to come. Right. It's Hatch green, and you can't explain that to people.
Yeah, I know. Nobody would quite get it.
So University of New Mexico, how did that compare to other universities? You're not working there, so we're not going to burn bridges. But is it a different environment, management-wise or student population-wise?
Well, you know, the University of New Mexico, like all universities, you know, has its bureaucratic hiccups.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a huge organization, and so yeah, you know, there's all that. But the University of New Mexico has. They are number one in the world in terms of students. The students that we teach at the University of New Mexico are absolutely adorable. And I can't wait till they grow up and take over the world. And these are not students like I taught at the University of Denver that come from very well-to-do families. These are students that are, most of them, working a job or sometimes two jobs or even a full-time job and going through, they don't have a sense of entitlement. They're courteous and respectful and smart. I'm very optimistic about.
So most of them are New Mexicans. They're not coming.
Yeah.
This is not a destination school like University of Florida.
Yes. So. Most of them are from New Mexico, although we certainly have students from around the country. But they're awesome New Mexico students.
I don't know for certain, but I got the impression that course credits, it's relatively expensive compared to other schools. Or is it right in line?
University of New Mexico?
Yes.
Oh, it's one of the best deals you can get for your money.
Okay.
So comparatively low.
Which is a good segue into communication and the impression I got from the news, or I just made it up, versus the reality. And that's, why don't you spend a few sentences on the PACE course, the title. Do you know the dates? The brochure says October 11th through the 25th.
Yeah.
So you get the prize.
Right.
And it is PlacitasAdultEducation.org. And that's where you can find how to register. Talk about a bargain. I think it's $100 a semester, and you can go to any or all of the classes.
Yes, it's a real good deal. And we've got some really exciting classes lined up for this fall.
But your class...
My class.
...is called Constructing the Human/Nature Relationship. Prior to speaking to you, I wasn't really sure exactly what that was. So let's tell everyone what it is, because they're going to want to go.
Okay, so this is a course that I've taught at the university for quite a number of years. And it's a course that is based on the textbook that I wrote that is being used in courses all over the country. And it's a very new and exciting, relevant, timely field of study called environmental communication. And that is a little broad and a little vague. It's based, the study of environmental communication is based on the premise that our reality, our human nature relationship, the way we view and treat the natural world, is greatly influenced or even determined by how that natural world is communicated to us.
So anything that is alive is part of the natural world?
It doesn't necessarily have to be alive. The natural world involves anything that we view as nature. It's often viewed as the big out there.
Okay, so like a glacier would be part of it.
Right, absolutely. So anything that we view as nature is the other side of the spectrum versus the human side of the spectrum. So it's the human-nature relationship.
And nature is nature, but it's also animals and insects and all that?
Yep, the natural world.
Is there, in this course of study, a definite line between humans and other life forms?
Well, no, there's a very problematic line between what is human and what is nature. And that line is very often difficult to distinguish. One of the problems that we see as humans encroach upon the natural world is that the animals whose land we have displaced encroach upon our world.
Yes.
Well, so here in Placitas, we have problems with wild horses. We have problems with, coyotes eating our free-range chickens.
Sure.
And so you tell me, Matt, where that line is. Where does nature start and civilization start?
I think it's getting blurrier and blurrier because depending on your perspective on things, there may be other life forms that didn't originate on this planet or other life forms on this planet that we're not necessarily aware of. I don't know if it's true or not, but with all of the wildfires in Brazil now, some scientists or naturalists are saying we've only discovered maybe a third of all the different species that are in that rainforest.
Right.
So I don't know where that line is and who's encroaching on whose space. And that kind of ebbs and tides, doesn't it? Depending,
it absolutely does.
So how do we understand this?
Well, I'm not sure that you and I could ever come to a definitive answer on where that line is between humans and nature. But it's important, but even attempting to draw that line is in some way problematic, because when we think of nature as the big out there, then it obscures consideration for the nature in our own backyard, which is essential to the nature of the big out there. The smokestacks in our own backyard impact nature in the Amazon. So the line is impossible to draw, and doesn't make any difference anyway. It's all one.
When you say the big out there, is that limited to planet Earth, or does that get involved with a potential asteroid, a planet killer coming in, or gamma ray bursts from the sun that could instantly fry us, and not, we wouldn't even know it would happen,
right,
so fast?
Right. Well, obviously, for those of us who are doing research in this area from the communication perspective, we're looking at it. We're pretty earthbound.
Well, that eliminates a lot of variables.
Right. Certainly does.
In your more than two decades of teaching at the university level, the students, or I guess 18 to, well, they're graduate students, so early 20s, have their perspectives changed from, say, 1995 versus 2015?
Yeah.
For the better?
Well, absolutely, from my perspective, for the better. The student, I started teaching this class in about 2008.
Okay.
And at that time, the students that were coming into my class were extraordinarily unaware of environmental issues, extraordinarily unknowledgeable about the things like climate change and what was happening, about one in every three of them probably didn't know anything about climate change, or they thought it was a hoax or some such. But now attitudes about that have changed significantly. Students are coming in there a lot more aware of the issues, a lot more aware of the problems than they were. And I think this is a very good trend.
And are they engaging in any way to have an impact?
They're all kind of wrapped up right now in getting their degree.
Understandable.
But this group of students that in the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years is much more community oriented. Something has happened. I think they've been taught the importance of giving back to the community, and they're just a lot more engaged in that sense. A lot more engaged in the social issues and problems and environmental issues that we are facing.
Did you also teach similar topics in California, at the university there? Or?
No. The study of environmental communication really didn't come into being as an area of research in academics. Until, when was it, about, I'd have to go back. But anyway, I was doing my PhD at the University of Denver when I became involved with the national organization that was at the forefront of putting this field of study together.
And with, you know, anybody who's doing undergraduate all the way up through the whole path, you take a lot of classes. Not necessarily what your major is or whatever. The students, at least at University of New Mexico, who have taken your class, were some of them studying nursing or astrophysics? Well, for those who, but what percentage do you think are going to pursue something similar as a career?
I'm not sure how to answer that. A lot of them are very interested in going on and finding a position in a nonprofit organization that works on some kind of environmental issue. So a lot of them will go from there to this, from this class to into something like that. But most of them, like you say, are just taking this as an elective.
Right.
It's a very popular course, so we get students from all walks of life. But whether or not they go on to become environmentalists is not really what I'm trying to do. My point is, let's really understand. Let's raise awareness. Let's learn.
Have a conversation.
Let's have this conversation. We desperately need to change the human-nature relationship.
From talking to the students over the years, are there a few examples of misconceptions that they come into the class with? Like, the moon's made of green cheese.
Right. I wouldn't say there's any real misconceptions. There's mm-hmm. funny little things like they're still concerned about the ozone layer, and they haven't distinguished between the good ozone and the bad ozone. Those little kinds of little
right.
things that you need to kind of straighten them out on. But they're pretty savvy coming in.
Are they aware of things such as with refrigerants? That whatever we used 20 years ago for some reason is banned, and now we have to use something that's 10 times the cost.
Yeah. No, it's those kind of details they're probably not too good on. And they're probably not going to learn too much about that kind of stuff in my class, because this is really not a class in environmental science.
Right.
This is a class in environmental communication.
So for the PACE class as well as your university class, like a syllabus, give me some examples of, especially for the PACE class, we want people to come because it's a really cool topic, but it's almost as important to know what we're not going to discuss versus what we are going to discuss.
Right.
So what are we going to discuss
what
at the class?
We're going to start out with the basic theory, spend just a little time, because it doesn't really make much sense what I do until you have the basic understanding of the theory behind what I do. And so we'll spend just a little time with that. But then we'll get right into current environmental problems, and we'll talk about the philosophies, the mainstream environmental philosophies that ground our thinking, the radical environmental philosophies that challenge the mainstream philosophies. We'll look at environmental rhetoric, which includes everything from things that from poetry and paintings, photographs, and how they impact our view of the natural world, to television shows and movies, how all that pop culture comes into our understanding. We'll talk about the role of risk science and technology in our understanding of the human-nature relationship, and why it is that sometimes the most compelling science fails to translate into policy and practice. So as you can see, it's a very, very broad discussion of things to look at. I'm having a little difficulty trying to figure out how to take this semester's-long course and turn it into an eight-hour session, but we'll mm-hmm. figure it out.
Or a 50-minute interview.
Right, exactly.
So we're bombarded by information all day long, from social media to reality TV, newspapers. We still have newspapers, right?
I think so.
Is there a major culprit of misinformation? Everyone talks about factcheck.com. Personally, I don't think I have a lot of faith in the information that I get. I have to really ferret out specific outlets to get what I think is, I don't want to quote a network, but a fair and balanced information.
Right.
Do you find that most people are horribly misinformed?
Well, I don't know about horribly misinformed. I think that most of us are guilty of allowing ourselves to fall into this echo chamber. That we read, we are able to look at just what we want to look at. It's a wonderful opportunity. We can bring up whatever we want to look at and ignore that which we don't want to look at. And as a result, and not only that, but the way that the social media platforms are set up in such a way that they can direct you, they can so clearly direct you into that echo chamber, and offer you feeds that play on what they know through the algorithms that you are understanding or that you are liking to listen to. And so, yeah, especially with technologies like they exist now, we are getting more and more and more isolated into our own little points of view that we reinforce time and time again by what we read and what we choose to look at.
How much of it, and maybe this is just my old age cynical perspective on things, most of the media exists because they have paid advertisers.
Exactly.
So how much of their message is crafted around, well, you know, U.S. Steel won't like if we run this story, so we don't run that story, or we really water it down.
Yeah.
Are we a victim of that a lot?
Well, I think we are to a large degree. The mainstream news organizations used to consider themselves a community service. Their purpose was to bring the news. And now that it is, its basic purpose is, bottom line, to attract advertisers.
It's entertainment.
And entertainment. And in order to attract advertisers, you've got to be entertaining enough that you have people watching you. So it really has a big impact on the kinds of things that we see on the news and the topics that are covered on the news, the way it is reported.
From the Socratic method that you'll be presenting the PACE course, and I should let everyone know that this is KUPR 99.9 in the high desert of Placitas, New Mexico. You can also stream the station 24 hours a day at kupr.org. What are some of these Socratic questions you were going to put out there for discussion?
Okay, well, that kind of depends on the topic that I'm talking about the day. But
well, I mean, at the PACE course.
Yeah.
Oh, from each one of the classes.
Right.
Right.
It's just very specific questions geared for each topic that we will be discussing.
Well, maybe some examples of topics.
Okay, that would be a good idea. One of the chapters that I'm going to have them read and that we will discuss is chapter 2, which is really environmental literacy. And we'll just do a short quiz on how much do you know about our current environmental problems. There's all kinds of environmental literacy quizzes running around. I kind of do my own version of that. But just to get a discussion of what are the issues that we are currently facing.
How much do you know, and how much of what you know is actually true?
Right. Good. Let's see. Then we're going to go into talking about the mainstream environmental perspectives, which are conservation and preservation, stewardship, and sustainable development are the ones that are discussed in the textbook. And what do these mean? What do these perspectives actually tell us about humans' relationship to the natural world? And then let's compare them to the radical environmental perspectives, which are getting a whole lot of voice these days, deep ecology, ecofeminism, and social ecology. Social ecology is especially important this day and age in what we're hearing and what people are talking about. So we'll take a real good look at environmental philosophies. Then I think we'll probably go into the chapter that discusses the rhetoric of risk science and technology.
Risk science.
Risk science and technology.
And what is that?
Okay, so there's really multiple ways of knowing and understanding the world. and one is cultural rationality. And I can tell you all about coyotes from my cultural rationality. I see them on the hillsides. I read about them in poetry books. But scientists can tell me all about coyotes in a completely different way called technical rationality. So technical rationality and cultural rationality are very frequently in conflict. And those who are the purveyors of technical rationality, that would be the scientists, and like yourself, recovering engineers.
Right.
That their messages and the message of cultural rationality often collide and compete. And how is it that so often the culture, the technical rationality takes precedent, and it certainly takes precedence in things like courts of law or in administrative hearings on should we put a gravel mine out there? Let's hear from the scientists. Let's hear what the scientists have to say. And we don't give much credence to cultural rationality. Well, what does the community think about this? What does this do to home values? What does this do to our views? Those kinds of things that are so important to us are often overlooked in this discussion of technical rationality.
There's a third leg to this stool that may not be enough of a segment of the population, but what comes to mind is, how about faith-based rationality? There are flat earth society, hollow earth society. There are some very strict religions that say the earth is 10,000 years old. Is there enough of a population that they get a voice in any of this?
I think that is a voice that should be included. I have not included that in my textbook, but I think that would be a good way to look. I think it would be a very small population, but...
Let's hope.
But nevertheless, faith-based religion has had a direct impact on the way we view and treat the natural world.
Certainly over the eons.
Absolutely. Back in the 1970s, a gentleman by the name of Len White Jr. published an essay about Christianity's role in our environmental problems. And the dominion paradigm, which is Genesis 1:28, that talks about how God gave dominion over the world and over the fish in the sea, you know, which just clearly establishes this hierarchy of God on top, humans here, and nature below, that we are in charge. God has given us this dominion, and it is ours to do with as we see fit.
Seems like a bad decision.
It seems like a real bad decision. Not that I want to question what God might have said, but we need to take a good look at that dominion paradigm and maybe look more towards a deep ecological view, which says we are not over the fish of the sea, that we are part of the fish of the sea, that we're all just part of one living organism.
This probably has nothing to do with your class, but my question popped in my mind, so it has to come out of my mouth. Is it possible that, regardless of religious teachings, that we are not at the top of the food chain, that maybe it's the dolphins or the elephants, that we just don't know? Just because they didn't build skyscrapers doesn't mean that they're not smarter than us.
That's a very interesting question. One of the things that we talk about in the book is, I don't know if you've ever seen the nature documentary called Grizzly Man.
No.
About the gentleman who spent 11 summers with the wild bears up in Alaska, with the grizzly bears, and he was eventually killed and eaten by the grizzly bears. And so now, who's on top of this food chain? Who's the eaten? You know, we have roles reversed. So that's kind of the point of taking a look at this hierarchy. Who determined who got to be here and who got to be here? And what does that mean?
And even though I don't think there's a lot of, I haven't seen a lot of conversation on this, but ants, incredibly complex engineers, and they're designed to withstand nuclear fallout or whatever. So just because they don't have TV shows, does that mean they're not smarter? They've got a whole world going on, yeah. and there are billions of them. Yeah. And if those types of creatures didn't exist, I mean, they're part of the recycling, the stuff that falls out of the canopies in the jungles. They make stuff with it. So I guess it depends how you define intelligence.
Absolutely. And it's very good questions. And these would be good discussion questions to be having in the course of this course.
Oh, good. In your teaching career, does something stand out in your mind of like, that's the best question I've ever heard?
Oh, gosh.
Other than all the ones I asked.
Yeah. Other than ones you've asked. You know what? Nothing's jumping out of me. I'd have to think about that for a while.
Right. So other chapter titles or class session discussions?
Well, let's see.
And it must be a bear to, I mean, things are moving so fast now in this field, you'd almost have to do a new book every 2 years. God forbid.
It's massive. Massive updating is required.
Is there stuff that you have thrown out from the first edition going, this just isn't relevant anymore?
Yes, absolutely. For example, one of the things in the first edition was these two researchers who put together what it's going to take to keep CO2 emissions at such and such a level by such and such a year, and they put together this wedge, and that we're going to have so many solar voltaic, and we're going to have so much wind power, and we're going to have to increase CAFE standards by such and such and such. So all these different things that we're going to have to do, that of course are now completely out of date, what with new research, and we've already exceeded where that pie chart was going to get us. And so, lots of updating.
Is there any thought given to that humans have evolved in certain ways or to adapt to our environment? Mm-hmm. Like the little toe, they say in how many more generations that'll kind of go away. No one really knows what the appendix ever did or what it's there. So as the makeup of our atmosphere changes, might we adjust to get by with less oxygen or become carbon dioxide breathers? Maybe we'll take care of it through evolution, since we may not take care of it through legislature and intelligence.
I really wish I knew the answer to that question. We're not looking at that in our area of study, but I hope somebody is. That would be very interesting. But
because I saw something years and years ago when we first started doing space exploration, and if there was life on other planets, especially ones with much less gravity or ones with a lot of gravity, like if there was a lot of gravity, we would probably be shorter because our spines couldn't support us, and maybe we would be on all fours instead of standing erect. And those are fascinating cocktail party conversations.
They are. That would be very fun to talk about. I don't know too much about phylogenetic adaptation on that level, but one of the things that we do talk about, there's an area of radical environmental thought called social ecology. And Murray Bookchin is the gentleman responsible, called the person who was sort of responsible for getting this way of thinking. And this talks about human adaptation, not so much physically, but in terms of our behaviors, in terms of our social living conditions. And so social ecology calls for us to adapt to completely different ways of living. That we are part of the adaption, that we are part of the evolution process. And we, as humans, have evolved in the wrong way. Let's re-evolve, let's readapt into better ways of living that are more sustainable.
And I need to be mindful of the fact that the class is not about 80% of what I've asked you. It's more about communication and how these ideas are communicated to us. Do you get involved with why are these ideas communicated to us? What's, I had an economics professor who said you can understand anything that goes on in the world, just follow the cash. And that's what makes every happen.
Follow the money, yes.
Right. Is that part of the conversation in your class?
Oh, absolutely. That comes up particularly strongly in the discussion of climate change skepticism. Where is it coming from? Who is sending out these messages? And like you say, follow the money. Follow the money. So
it's like fracking is good, fracking is bad.
Right.
Eggs are good, eggs are bad.
Exactly.
When I was 20, 200 cholesterol was the target. I'm sorry, 300. Then all of a sudden it became 200. How did that happen? So it's that message that I think is closer to the conversation you're going to have at the PACE class.
Exactly.
And so how will we be better equipped to go through our day-to-day life and be a responsible member of the community by understanding more of this?
Well, that's a very good question. The thing that we all need to keep in mind, and the thing that needs to be stressed to all of us time and time and time again, is that there are multiple realities. Realities are not so much a function of the extant reality that is out there, that tree that I can go out and touch and feel. My idea of that tree is not really so much constructed by that reality of the tree as it is by what I have been told about that tree. And what I have been told about that tree by others through news reports, through education, through environmental documentaries, through conservative think tanks, wherever these messages are coming from, largely determine how I view and treat that tree. So that it's really important that we understand these multiple realities and where that we're coming from.
And who commissioned that report and for the think tank to write.
Exactly.
So is that Facebook bias? Is that just, not to pick on Facebook, but that's one of the largest sources of bias, in groupthink. All of my friends on Facebook, if I had any friends, we tend to join groups, people who are like-minded.
Right.
So I'm not getting the intellectual exposure to other ideas, that's what makes you grow. So is that part of what you're going to...
That's absolutely part of the message, be careful what you read. Be aware of where the message is coming from and open yourself up to multiple viewpoints. Listen to the other side every now and then. Don't get caught in your echo chamber.
So, Placidus is not non-apologetically a very Democrat, I call it a Hillary community. So should once a month, should we take a Republican to lunch?
I think that's a swell idea.
You think that's
idea? Okay. I think it's a great idea.
I just have to find one.
Yeah, if we could find one out here. No, I think that's a wonderful idea. I wish we could find a way to open up this dialogue so it didn't have to be so divided.
And so dismissive.
Yes.
You had mentioned earlier greenwash. I think that's an interesting area we could talk about.
Yeah, that's a fun area of study within environmental communication. We are bombarded daily with messages about this green product or buy this green product, or this company is a green company. This company really cares about the environment, so buy our products. And this product has a particular environmental seal that proves that it's an environmentally sound product. And so much of that kind of advertising, when you really take a look at the product, when you look at the product from its birth to its disposal, you find out that it's not such a green product after all. So we take a look at what we call greenwash, which are misleading or false green environmental claims. So if anything, I would hope a student would come out of this class being a little bit more critical and a little bit more aware of and skeptical of all those green claims and green ads.
So in simple terms, read the label.
Read the label.
Because there's a lot of information there.
Read the label and then find out where the label came from. I mean, find out about this product. And it's easy to do. You know, we can Google anything these days. You can find out about products. So
I just don't know if it's correct or not.
Right.
I mean, it's... Well, and that kind of is the other question I was thinking about. There are many people who go, I'm done. I don't want to know anything about any of this. I want to get up and watercolor or play music, right, or go play soccer. And, you know, the rest of you all can figure it out because I'm not going to be here for the consequences. Are more people dropping out? Like in the 60s?
Yeah.
Tune out, turn on, whatever it was. Right.
That's actually a very common response. One of the things, a theory that I talk about, a theory that I actually published earlier is the ghost response to climate change, giving up hope of stopping the threat. I think we are bombarded with these messages that are so dire and so frightening, and they create for us this ghost, this thing that is beyond understanding. This huge thing is beyond human control. This huge thing that is a product of our own iniquitous behaviors. Because we are such voracious consumers, we have caused climate change, and now it's coming back to haunt us. So the way that this whole thing is constructed as a ghost, as a specter,
mm-hmm.
You even hear lots of rhetoric, the specter of global warming. The way it's constructed for us kind of leaves us in a position, well, it's unknowable, it's too big, it's too powerful, there's nothing I can do.
I mean, I have heard comments with, and to your point, excuse me, you can't drink the water, you can't breathe the air, the soil is totally polluted with all kinds of stuff, the oceans are just a big cesspool. So you can't fix it. Well, the fix is that over the next 1,000 years, humankind dies off, the planet will heal itself, and then we'll start over again. But all of the things that we're doing that seem admirable really will not have any major effect at this point, because we're not going to get... you know, Culligan to come clean up the ocean. They're not going to filter the whole thing out.
Right.
So is it inappropriate to be hopeless?
Well, I don't know about inappropriate. And it certainly is understandable. It certainly is an understandable response. But the groundswell, there's a lot of encouragement that's going on as well. The groundswell of people who are beginning to get involved, and things like the Paris Accord, where nations of the world get together and make agreements, and then let's throw in technological advancements. Let's throw in lowering CAFE standards. Let's just do everything that we can. And I think we can avoid the worst of it. I think we can avoid the worst of it if we act now and if we act quickly and if we act globally.
Avoid it or prolong the agony?
Yeah, which is it?
Yeah. How do you pull off that Band-Aid?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, no secret, many people are selfish. So why should I be stuck in a 1,000-pound car with 4D cells when I want my F-650?
Right.
Is that really going to make any significant difference? People will say, oh, I'm going to give up XYZ food so I can live an extra 6 months.
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked me this question, because one of my beefs is the individualization of responsibility, where it says, you know, Matt, you're responsible for climate change because you drive that monster truck and because you fly to Florida every year and whatever. It's your fault. You're a voracious consumer. So what I want you to do is make the sacrifices. I want you to sacrifice and give up these things because you're responsible, all right? I don't like that message. I mean, you know, you are responsible for a tiny, tiny, tiny little drop in this massive, massive bucket. What all the sacrifices that you can make in the world really won't make much difference in comparison to the kinds of changes that could happen if we raised CAFE standards.
Right.
The kind of changes that could happen if we just, I don't know that we could ever just prohibit, but if we put in, for example, a carbon tax, the kinds of massive changes that could happen on that level, on the government level and on the corporate level, as opposed to the kind of changes that you could make with sacrifices in your everyday life.
I have heard that one of the personal decisions that people can make that contributes more to negative environmental impact than any is having a kid.
I would imagine, yeah. I thought you were going to say flying in an airplane, but yeah.
No. So, you know, I don't know if it's still the rules in China, but like one baby. People who have the Brady Bunch or something, but they're organic. Isn't that a little hypocritical? It is very hypocritical.
Well, yeah, it is hypocritical. And then
and that comes back to the whole thing, even though, you know, we're not going to have individual discussions like this at the class. It's communication. But it's with everything, personal responsibility. I try to exercise because it's my responsibility to myself to do that. I'm not a gym rat, but I try to remain flexible or whatever so I don't break a hip or hurt myself. Or if I want to have a more environmental car, that's what I feel is the right thing to do. Treat people a certain way. That, I think, will have as much impact on anything long-term as anything, you know, individually. You know, war is a horrible pollutant.
Absolutely.
So, and that, to bring it back to what the PACE class is, it's those messages. And some of those messages are filtered out. When we hear environmental studies, we don't talk about all of the pollution from just one day of war on the planet. Mm-hmm. Everybody's wars, not just our wars. Mm-hmm. That's never discussed.
Right.
So which one of your chapters would that be in?
Well, actually, I do. I briefly mentioned that in the very beginning, talking about the things that we view as environmental versus the things that aren't environmental. So why isn't war an environmental issue when it creates so much environmental damage? So yes, it's briefly mentioned, but
okay. Well, believe it or not, we're almost out of time. Do you have any, want to make a pitch for your class? Come see me because.
Yeah. I hope that you will find this class to be as enlightening as my students find it. It's one of the most popular classes on campus. And the course is always full, and it's full of information, and it's, I don't know, I hope it will be a very good learning experience, a very good discussion experience for us, very good eye-opening experience.
And fun.
Let's have fun.
I mean,
fun.
This is not a, even though they're serious topics and some serious, you know, some downers, it's still a great thing to talk about, and I think that that is a way to move forward, is if we all discuss it.
Right.
And not, you know, I say this all the time, what is presented to us in the media? It's sex, money, politics, and that's what we all watch, reality TV. Can you have a dinner with two or three people and talk about sex and politics? And no, that's not going to, but that's how you move forward. It's kind of this weird environment that we're in.
It is. But
not to advertise or promote anything, but if somebody wanted a copy of the book just because, or the textbook, because it's one of a kind probably, Where would it be available?
You can get it on Amazon, and it's
you can get everything on it. Can I get it in one day now?
It's called Communication in the Natural World, and it's published by Strata Publishing.
By Dr. Judith Hendry. Super. Well, thank you for coming up here to Bronson Towers. any parting words?
No. It's just been a pleasure, and thank you very much, Matthew.
So for KUPR and the Matthew Bronson Show, thank you, and we'll see you next time.